voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Stories. Iran says it informed the UN nuclear agency last week of its decision to produce uranium metal enriched to 20% purity for Tehran reactor fuel. A U.S. base at Erbil Airport in northern Iraq comes under attack by explosive-laden drones. The Pentagon says there were no injuries or any damage. Also in the headlines, New York becomes the first U.S. state to declare a disaster emergency order to address rising gun violence. Iran has announced it will soon produce uranium metal enriched to 20% purity. The country says the uranium silicide plate will be used as fuel in Tehran reactor. Earlier, we were joined by our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lesgi, who gave us the details.
The decision that's been announced now, and the IAEA was informed of this, according to Mr. Ali Bobadi, Iran's ambassador, 9 days ago, is Iran is now going to produce uranium metal plates, or in the words of Mr. Ali Bobadi, a silicide fuel plate, using enriched uranium, and uranium that's been enriched up to 20%. So this is the first time that this is going to happen in Iran. And in his own statement, Mr. Ali Bobadi goes on to give a bit of clarification what this silicide fuel plate means. He says that silicide fuel is a modern kind of nuclear fuel, and you said there only a handful of countries have the technology to produce it. Iran, we know, the agency had said before this that it had already produced uranium metal, but not using enriched uranium. So Mr. Ali Bobadi confirmed that Iran had been conducting research and development on this about 3 months ago, but now the new process involves using 20% enriched uranium to make this silicide fuel plate. And what is it used for? Tehran, of course, saying that it's for the research reactor in Tehran as fuel. And Mr. Ali Bobadi also mentioned in his statement that this development is going to significantly improve the quality and quantity of radiopharmaceuticals. Already a statement by the E3 countries, Germany, France, and Britain, who are the other signatories to the JCPOA, who have been engaged in talks here in Vienna to revive the nuclear deal. They have been describing this act by Iran, in their own words, as threatening the successful outcome of the talks. They've been saying that it is more concerning at a time when no date has been set for the continuation of the Vienna talks.
Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted a ceremony dubbed Revealing U.S. Rights Violations. The event comes on the heels of a week-long occasion called the U.S. Human Rights Week that recounts the U.S. hostile policies against Iranians. Youssef Jalali reports.
The U.S., a defender or a violator of human rights. These people take the second option, and they say they have documented reasons to prove it. Iran has just wrapped up a fateful week it calls the U.S. Human Rights Week to review tragic incidents in the 1980s that killed hundreds of Iranians. Activists in this conference say the U.S. footprints can be traced in all of those incidents.
We are marking the American Human Rights Week, which is actually a jab at the U.S.'s bleak record of rights violations. In this week, Iranians marked the tragic downing of passenger plane in 1988 by an American missile shot from its Winston ship in the Persian Gulf. Instead of apologizing to Iranians, the U.S. honored the captain who ordered the firing of the missile and gave him the Medal of Honor.
Among the events that fall in this period is the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the incident. The U.S. and Europe do not recognize the MKO as a terrorist entity and hold regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania.
The MKO terrorists are puppets of the U.S. that have been trying to harm the Islamic Republic since its establishment. They carried out failed assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei when he was president in 1981. They have killed thousands of Iranians in different terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. and Europe delisted them as a terrorist entity and accommodate them. This shows how insincere are the Americans in their human rights slogans.
Activists here believe the U.S. has not changed its hostile behavior toward Iranians. They refer to the ongoing anti-Iran sanctions as economic terrorism that seeks to fulfill the same goals it failed to achieve in the 1980s.
The maximum pressure campaign sought to bring Iranians to their knees to finally pit them against the government. But as you see, this plot has failed, like several other conspiracies they hatched against Iran.
The victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution marked the end of decades of U.S. dominance over Iran's economy and its petroleum sector, something which is believed to be the main reason why the U.S. has made so many attempts to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic, including its support for Iraq in its 8 years of war against Iran, and its unconditional support for the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, and today, by unleashing the toughest sanctions that have overshadowed Iran's health sector.
This gathering is held at the former U.S. Embassy in Iran, which has now turned into a museum that showcases documents of Washington's hostile agenda against Iran. Activists here say the U.S. adopts a selective approach towards the issue of human rights, at least in Iran. But they say it's time for the world to know the truth. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
A U.S. military base has come under attack at Erbil Airport in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, sounding sirens at a nearby U.S. consulate in the city. Local security sources said bomb-laden drones were used in the attack, which prompted a suspension of flights at the airport. In a statement, the Pentagon said it was aware of reports about a drone attack, but initial information did not indicate structural damage or any injuries. This comes a day after rockets hit U.S.-run Ain al-Assad Air Base in Anbar province. Anti-U.S. sentiments have been on the rise since the United States assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near Baghdad's international airport in January 2020. The move promoted, prompted Iraqi lawmakers to vote for the expulsion of U.S. forces from the country. A recent report implicates the United Kingdom in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. We discussed that issue at length with our guests in our news review program.
reports suggest that British forces are providing training and support to Saudi-backed forces and mercenaries in Yemen. According to news outlet Declassified UK, some 30 British soldiers have been stationed at Al-Qaeda Airport in the eastern Yemeni province of Mahra. A local journalist was cited by the outlet as saying that British troops there are a fully fledged force. The report challenges London's claims that it is not party to the war on Yemen. The UK has long been criticized for its arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition, which has been waging a deadly war on Yemen for over 6 years. Joining us now for the program is Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, joining us out of Bristol, Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, I would like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Tony, we'll start there with you in Bristol there. Your thoughts, somewhere in the midst of all this, do the truth lies? Where do you think it's at?
This, I'm afraid, as a British journalist, this is bad news for us, but it shows that really this, it's more evidence, isn't it, that this is a proxy war, that this is not something that the Saudis are just doing for their own interests. And obviously, you know, there are all sorts of questions about what the motives might be if it was just Saudi. The British troops are in there. We know also that there's been a lot of RAF personnel in Saudi Arabia itself. So this is really, it's becoming a little bit clearer. Maybe the scales are falling from our eyes a bit more, as they've done. I mean, it's a great job, Declassified UK, I've got to say. Excellent job that this website has done. Of course, none of this will be being reported on any of the mainstream outlets here in the UK. You might find something in the newspapers tomorrow, a few lines, potentially. But really, this is the Julian Assange tradition. Declassified UK is, for example, John Pilger wrote a very important book with Mark Curtis, the co-founder of Declassified UK. These are the journalists, like myself, I have to say, who are basically shut out of the UK mass media, even though we're more than qualified to be on there, because the media in Britain and the West generally is becoming a place where it's almost impossible to expose. Look what's happened to Assange, as he's exposed these sorts of crimes. That's why it's called Declassified. This is the job of good journalists, is to find out what our government and our taxpayers' money is being spent on criminal acts, basically gangsterism of various sorts, and to expose it to the public so that they can hopefully, through the voting system, correct these errors and also shame these people into resignation. Now, this is not the role anymore, really, for the last 20 years or so of the Western media. And so it's up to people like me and to Declassified, etc., to dig these facts out and to expose them. So these, there's a Saudi-backed force, and then what they're doing is they're also backing mercenaries. So this is really guns for hire. So this is a very important piece of work done by an excellent journalist. Mark Curtis's book, really, Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam, is an absolute must-read. And of course, it never gets talked about, and Mark never gets, you never see him on the mainstream news, because this is taboo. That's the word for it, taboo. You're not allowed to talk these facts. And in fact, I'm sure there's quite a lot of people at the Ministry of Defence that would like to see Mark Curtis in jail alongside Julian Assange for exposing these sorts of things. So anyway, great work by Declassified UK. I think they should get a medal, and the Ministry of Defence, I think, would like to probably send them to jail.
Thank you, Tony. Robert, like, welcome you to the program here. Your initial thoughts on this, please.
I think we're seeing certainly what Tony said, but also we have to remember that the UK, United States, most Western powers aren't interested in human rights. They're not interested in peace. They don't care about suffering people. They care about profits. They care about power. The UK makes a lot of money from its arms sales to the Saudis, and the fact that UK soldiers are now training or actually involved in the war against the Yemeni people is not surprising. It's all part and parcel of the same thing. This idea that money is to be made, Saudi Arabia wants to install a new government in Yemen that is more friendly to it, so it doesn't matter how many people die. You mentioned 250,000 Yemenis have died from starvation, lack of medicine, lack of electricity. These are horrible ways of dying. And yet the UK obviously doesn't care about them because they are selling arms to Saudi and they are Saudi Arabia, and they are now providing soldiers to support the mercenaries. This is, as you mentioned, guns for hire. They are paid assassins. There is no justice in this whatsoever. The people, the powers that be, know that the average person doesn't want to support this war. However, as Tony further mentioned, it's to further the geopolitical goals of various governments, in addition to the profits that I mentioned, and so they keep it secret, they keep it quiet. You mentioned the Sandinistas under President Reagan in the United States. Going back a little bit further, in the late 50s, early 60s, U.S., in violation of international law, had several thousand troops in Vietnam, two or three thousand troops. The general public didn't know about this, and we see how that turned out. It just went from bad to worse to disastrous. So the government doesn't want the people to know about these things because they may rise up, they'll vote against them, and they will defeat their goals for power and profits around the world.
Thank you, both of you gentlemen. Stay safe. Always a pleasure to have you both on. Tony Gosling there joining us from Bristol, and Mr. Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. And that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
New York has become the first U.S. state to declare a disaster emergency order to address rising gun violence.
And it is an emergency. And I want the people of the state to understand that. And I want them to respond to the emergency for the way it is. So today, first state in the nation is going to declare a disaster emergency on gun violence.
The governor added that the state saw 51 shootings over the 4th of July holiday weekend. The directive will funnel nearly $140 million toward gun violence intervention and prevention programs. Under the executive order, a special police unit to fight firearms trafficking into the state will also be created. The directive follows the Independence Day weekend, when at least 150 people were killed and more than 400 shootings across the country. Commentator Matthew Fox says there are more guns available to Americans than to any other person or people in the world.
That's the way it has been. And like I said, the fact that guns rights people said, hey, everybody has a right to bear arms and you have a right to have guns. And guns, this country has more guns on the street than any other country in the world, especially when you're talking about developing countries. So the reality of it is that you've got this war on drugs, where you don't have jobs, but people can go out and sell drugs. If you sell drugs, you're going to protect your drugs. You're going to protect your interests. So you got to take the law in your own hands, and that's where these guns come into play at. So they're going to have to ratchet down on that whole drug scenario. They got to ratchet that thing down, make it a physical harm reduction system, bring that into play, and at the same time start trying to buy these guns off the street. But as far as the rhetoric that's coming out of Cuomo and what's going on in New York,
sure,
all I can say again is welcome aboard the Enterprise. This has been going on for decades. You should have called it an emergency 10 years ago.
That's it for me for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
Boris Johnson has to announce that the lifting of most remaining COVID-19 restrictions in England will go ahead on 19th of July amid a backlash from government scientific advisers who have warned that doing so would be like building a new variant factory. Despite cases having risen to their highest level since January of 2021, the Prime Minister is set to press ahead with the final stage of unlocking in 2 weeks. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Overy Allegretti and Linda Geeds. The piece is titled, PM to Confirm 19 July End to COVID Rules Despite Scientists' Warnings. Boris Johnson is to announce that the lifting of most remaining COVID-19 restrictions in England will go ahead on 19th of July amid a backlash from government scientific advisers who have warned that doing so would be like building new variant factories. Despite cases having risen to their highest level since January of 2021, the Prime Minister is set to press ahead with the final stage of unlocking in 2 weeks. In a Downing Street press conference on Monday afternoon, 5th of July, Boris Johnson announced that with 86% of adults in the United Kingdom having had at least a first jab, the government will move from relying on legal curbs to control people's behavior to letting individuals make their own decisions. Changes to be announced include allowing fully vaccinated adults to travel to amber list countries without having to self-isolate when they return home, making the wearing of face masks voluntary, apart from in hospitals and other healthcare settings, and no longer requiring fully vaccinated adults to self-isolate if they have come into contact with an infected person. The school bubble system that has forced hundreds of thousands of pupils to quarantine at home if someone in their bubble tested positive is also expected to be dropped, while pub and restaurant customers may no longer have to scan an NHS QR code. The different approach to tackling COVID was supported by the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, who claimed it will be impossible to eradicate the disease and that the country would have to find ways to cope with it, as with the flu. The Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, also said the health arguments for opening up were compelling, but conceded dangerous new variants of coronavirus could emerge that current vaccines were ineffective against. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is due to reveal the results of government reviews into social distancing and COVID status certificates as well. The Guardian revealed last week that ministers were planning to remove all mandatory mask and social distancing restrictions in England from 19th of July, though national guidance may remain in place, encouraging caution in high-risk areas, such as on public transport. COVID status certificates, an idea that Boris Johnson once championed as a way to allow access to places such as theatres for those who can prove that they have been vaccinated, had a recent negative test result, or have antibodies, are also expected to be ditched, though government sources have hinted they could be reintroduced in the winter. Conservative MPs who were once more cautious have mostly been convinced the time is right for mass unlocking, with one saying it was becoming clear rising infections were not remotely correlated to hospitalizations or deaths, so we just got to get on with it. But another Tory figure warned the science may become a second thought after 19th of July. Robert Jenrick, the community secretary, revealed on Sky News he would shed his face mask as soon as possible, while Professor Adam Finn, a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said he would carry on wearing a face mask indefinitely when in an enclosed, crowded space. Concern is building among scientists about the new wave of infections in the United Kingdom and ministers' determination to press on with unlocking. Stephen Riker, a professor at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, who is also a member of the government subcommittee advising on behavioural science, said, "It is frightening to have a health secretary who still thinks COVID is flu, who is unconcerned at levels of infection, who doesn't realise that those who do best for health also do best for the economy, who wants to ditch all protections while only half of us are vaccinated." He added, "Above all, it's frightening to have a health secretary who wants to make all protections a matter of personal choice, when the key message of the pandemic is, this isn't an I thing, it's a we thing." Professor Susan Michie, the director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London, who sits on the same subcommittee, said, allowing community transmission to surge is like building new variant factories at a very fast rate. Meanwhile, a further 24,248 cases were reported in the United Kingdom on Sunday, 4th of July, up from 15,953 cases on the same day the previous week. There were a further 15 deaths. The northeast of England recorded a particular surge in infections, with South Tyneside reporting a 195% increase in the 7 days to 29th of June. Gates said a 142% increase, and Sunderland a 131% increase. Only Oxford and Tamworth have recorded greater increases during this period, with all five areas having a prevalence of between 480 and 585 coronavirus cases per 100,000 of the population. Something weird is happening in the northeast of England, and it's a bit worrying, said Christina Pagel, a professor of operational research at University College London. Not only were cases there rising rapidly, so were hospitalizations and the proportion of tests recording a positive result, she said. Other scientists are saying the relaxation of many of the restrictions, while not risk-free, do make sense.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ministry.
Move on Tuesday, June 22nd, the U.S. Justice Department seized 36 websites with links to the Islamic Republic of Iran and its regional allies for engaging in, quote, disinformation campaigns and malign influence operations, unquote. The move initially arose suspicions of a hack since a disclaimer that said this website has been seized accompanied an Arabic text as the one you can still see on PressTV.com. While State Department spokesman Ned Price refused to comment. The Empire's Justice Department eventually said three of the seized domains belonged to the Iraqi group Kata'ab Hezbollah, while the rest, including Yemeni, Palestinian, and Bahraini outlets in English and Arabic, were supported by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union. The seized websites obviously belonged to outlets of the allied resistance communities, better known as the Resistance Axis, that Iran supports across the region to counter the influence of the U.S. and regional rivals like Israel and Saudi Arabia. Try to keep a straight face here. The U.S. blacklisted us with designations related to terrorism. I kid you not. The mother of all terrorism, also known as the Empire, said that the American companies are not allowed to provide us with .com and .net domains without special authorization from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC. U.S. fascist officials can choose to label it however they wish, yet they will never be able to change the fact that this seizure is a clear example of a systematic effort to distort freedom of speech on a global level and silence independent voices in media, which gives us and everyone included in the seizure the full right to pursue the issue through legal channels. While the U.S. may have given itself the ability to exert influence over vast sections of the internet, its actions will for sure have far-reaching ramifications beyond its control. Those unilateral harassment actions will only give credence to arguments of U.S. interference and censoring due to fear of being further exposed by native media in nations they continue to sanction like Iran, occupy like Iraq, and bomb like Yemen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. More than 30 web domains linked to the Axis of Resistance, one of which is Press TV, were blatantly seized by U.S. agencies last week. The U.S. seized sites operated inside Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, as well as social media channels affiliated with the Iraqi resistance, the PMU. The seizures come as the Biden administration is in the midst of negotiations over Tehran's nuclear program and follow the election of a new president who has been criticized by Washington for being a staunch detractor of its imperial foreign policy. Now, the Iranian government condemned this act of censorship as unlawful and part of an influence campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran. To discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media and a tech expert. Thank you very much for being with us, Hadi. Now, visitors of the affected websites by the seizure, by the U.S. Seizure, were greeted with a banner that says that the domain name has been seized by the U.S. government as part of, I quote, enforcement action taken by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Bureau of Industry and Security. Now, if you want to define and maybe phrase this, just put it into words, how would you do that?
First of all, we need to understand one thing, which is that what happened was that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized the DNS side of the website, not the actual site. So it's what tells the when a person browses for a site, he types a name. The DNS service is what tells the browser that this name belongs to this IP address. This link is what the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized. That's basically what happened in the first part.
So that would you putting it into actual words, but that actual seizure from a tech point of view, how much time would have that have taken, and what would the tools be that they use to do that?
Since they have access to the actual DNS service, from a local company inside the U.S., which runs these DNS addresses, they can do it easily with one court order. They can directly seize control on anything which is considered on U.S. soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokeswoman had declared when that happened before? It declared that this act of we can call it internet fascism by the U.S., was performed that by the U.S. government because it has a right to seize the .com, .net, and .org domain names simply because the companies have the contracts to administer them are based on U.S. soil. If that is the case, wouldn't such actions urge people to move away from these domain names to try and at least protect their work?
Well, basically, they should understand. The people should start to understand that since there is no actual real internet governance, which is in unbiased hands, they should know that whenever they buy any of these domains, they are susceptible to being seized by the U.S. government. Knowing that, if you want to go to the legal side of it, the U.S. should only be enforcing whatever is ends with a .us. So it might be .com, then .us, or like, for example, in Lebanon .com.lb, and whatever other country .me, for example. It depends on which country. So each country can have access to its own domains if it was the unbiased way to achieve such a thing. But sadly, what's happening is that they have control over all the .com, the .net, even the .org, since the companies that run these domains are on American soil, and VeriSign, which is the company that runs the .com and .net, is very very closely tied to the system.
You mentioned VeriSign, Hadi, and it's a U.S.-based internet backbone, a company that has the contract to manage the coveted.com and other generic top-level domains, the ones that you just mentioned, and it has a very cozy relationship, and I mean cozy, that's described by the U.S. media, not by me, with the federal government, with the FBI, and has long had a contract from the U.S. government to help manage the internet's root file, which is the key to having a unified internet name system. What would now stop other international corporation for assigned names and numbers from following suit of unleashing a global government crackdown on domain names that simply do not abide by Western values or Western narratives, or just simply are not liked by the US, the UK, or any other Western regime?
Again, sadly, we are at a point where nothing can stop such seizures happening in anywhere in the world, since they have ultimate access to all these things. There's the ICANN, ICANN. They were under American control for some time, and then they released that control, and they started making 13 multiple organizations governing each part of the world. They are non-governmental organization. They don't get paid by any government. And they are one step towards global internet governance, trying to make internet unbiased location. But still, the US hasn't released its hand over these names. So we get to a loop where we are susceptible to have our domains seized at any moment just by being connected to any ideology or any political stance which is maybe anti-US or anti-West, or maybe not doesn't go well with the US comprehension of things.
Or simply, if you're going to compete with the U.S., we did see that happening to a lot of also Chinese websites where they were seized, they were put down. But I had a technical question concerning something that you mentioned about the .com.lb, for example. Is that more secure from the .com by itself? If I'm going to go with the .com.ir instead of just .com, should that be more safe than just going with the domain name .ir?
Your own country's domain, for example, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's the .ir, which is governed by Iranian law. It has nothing to do with American governance over the internet. So, of course, it's much safer to invest in your own domain. And maybe if you want, you can link a .com to it for SEO purposes, which later on might have other issues. But that's another technical path.
So you mean that only having a .ir might make it hard to find it on a search engine?
Yes, true. Because the crawlers work in a different way, and also the search engine itself might be biased. It might push things which aren't actually relevant.
Hello, Google.
Exactly.
Well, many outside the United States, like China, Russia, India, they distrust this U.S. cozy tech companies, especially with the big tech companies, the social media ones, and have been vocal about wanting to see control being shared all across the world, which is just fair, at least to say it's fair, of the internet's naming system. They want to see it turned over to an organization such as the International Telecommunications Union, right, an affiliate of the United Nations. Now, look, once you say UN, I, for one, as a citizen of West Asia, I am a bit panicking once I hear the word UN. Why? Because it is an international body, but it's a biased body.
True.
So what are we actually doing here?
Maybe this makes it less susceptible to U.S. seizure, but in the end, it will be biased. But since it presents itself as an unbiased organization, it gives us a range of movement to work with such institutes.
So it might actually protect domain names or might just get them on board a certain committee that would have to study if that domain name
exactly.
is used or
it,
not.
It gets them maybe on the side where instead of having, like, for example, you sleep and then you wake up with 30-plus websites being seized, you'll wake up with a warning, and then things will start to take a bit of meetings from here, discussions there, debates here, until they get to a certain...
But wouldn't that just threaten freedom of speech?
At the end of the day, it is
a form of censorship.
Exactly. That's what's happening.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media, for explaining to us what actually happened when the U.S. blatantly decided to take over our websites and the websites of our sister channels as well. Thank you very much for being with us. It was great content from you, Hadi. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what is going on in the occupied West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Seems that death in Palestinian authority custody no longer differs than that of the Israeli occupation's use of ruthless excessive force against Palestinians during incarceration, and that's being said sadly. An outspoken critic of the Palestinian Authority who intended to run in the parliamentary elections before they were actually canceled earlier this May died during his arrest in Hebron by Palestinian Authority forces on Thursday. Yizhar Banat, 44 years old, was a harsh critic of the Palestinian Authority, which governs part of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, and called on Western nations to cut off aid to it because of its growing authoritarianism and human rights violations. More in this following report.
Hundreds of Palestinian natives continue to gather on a daily basis in the city of Ramallah to protest over the death of activist Yizhar Banat after being dragged by excessive force out of his home on Thursday, June 24th at 3:30 a.m. in the morning by the Palestinian Authority security forces. Angry demonstrators gathered in the city of Ramallah, the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority, to chant slogans against President Mahmoud Abbas 2 days after Abbas's forces arrested and killed activist Yizhar Banat. They carried Palestinian flags, photos of Banat, and signs demanding the fall of the regime. Protests were also held in Hebron and El Bire. Palestinian security forces then launched a heavy barrage of tear gas into the crowd of hundreds in Ramallah and attacked protesters and several journalists. Earlier, plainclothes security forces spread out among protesters as they marched from the center of Ramallah towards the presidential offices and closed off the intersection leading to the area, forcing shops to close. One video from the protest showed security forces in plain clothes dragging a protester across the road as they simultaneously beat him.
القيادة الفلسطينية التقليدية هذه اللي حكمت الضفة الغربية اليوم طول عمرها هيك بتتاجر بكل شيء.
But who is Banat and why is his death, which some is now dubbing as an assassination, so significant? The prominent Palestinian political activist and an advocate of free speech was known for his outspoken videos on social media criticizing the Palestinian Authority for its corruption, as well as its shameful security coordination with the Israeli occupation forces in the occupied West Bank. A former member of the Farah movement himself, the de facto ruling party of the Palestinian Authority, Banat had been campaigning as a candidate for legislative elections on the Freedom and Dignity list. The elections initially scheduled for May were postponed by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in April. While Abbas cited the voting rights of Palestinians living in occupied East Al-Quds as a reason to push back the elections, critics have accused him of seeking excuses to avoid a vote due to his party's unpopularity. Banat was well known for his extensive knowledge of Palestinian political and social history. often recalling anecdotes about the Palestinian Liberation Organization PLO in the 1970s or the British Mandate of Palestine before 1948 in order to make his point. In May, bullets, stun grenades, and tear gas were fired at the Banat family home while his wife and children were inside. Banat accused ruling party Fatah of being behind the attack and called on the European Union to cut its financial aid to the Palestinian Authority. Banat had also accused the Palestinian Authority of perpetrating torture on political dissidents detained in its prisons. Hence, his sudden death while in the hands of the Palestinian Authority sparked outrage and dismay in the Palestinian streets, which many believe has triggered the inevitable downfall of the Palestinian Authority.
So with us to discuss this issue is Mr. Ali Murad, who's political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, just like that, a brief statement was given by the Hebron Governorate saying that Nizar Banat's health deteriorated while he was in custody when Palestinian forces arrested him from his house earlier on Thursday, and that he was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. This is definitely not the first case where we see a detainee dying while in custody of the Palestinian Authority security forces. However, this man was known to have faced direct threats from members of the Palestinian Authority. How come this matter escalated to a point that whoever arrested him ended up just murdering him?
Thank you for hosting me. Of course, martyr Nizar Banat was threatened nearly on a daily basis. He had told his friends and his family that he is receiving death threats weeks before the assassination took place. Nizar's problem is that he was outspoken. He never, ever was able to louder his voice when talking about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority and all the security apparatus that Mahmoud Abbas rules the West Bank using it. So Nizar Banat, I think, was the man who had the bravery and all the strength that many others lack. He used his voice to speak. He never held a gun to shoot at the security forces or any member of the Palestinian Authority. All he had his voice, his bravery, talking about what is wrong, the corruption, the security coordination with the Zionist enemy that Mahmoud Abbas is insisting on keeping. So I think other circumstances maybe has led to the assassination of Nizar, because after the battle of the Al-Quds sword, the Palestinian Authority sensed that the popularity, its popularity is going down. So
Mr. Ali, before I even contacted you to come and be our guest speaker, I spoke with four different Palestinian natives living in the West Bank who canceled right after actually saying, yes, we'd be happy to talk about Nizar, but they canceled because they were afraid that they would be incarcerated
exactly.
themselves. So it's a real police state there.
Exactly.
And as you said, Nizar didn't even have a weapon to defend himself, because weapons are also not allowed because of the coordination, the security coordination with Israel. But in early May, he had gunmen firing bullets, tear
exactly.
gas, grenade, stun grenades at his house while his wife and his children were inside the house. He blamed the attack on Mahmoud Abbas himself and the Fatah party. Now, is there something that could have been done to avert them attacking his house again, or is it just too complicated to talk about it as if it's something that should not happen? Because we don't really have a lot of information coming out of the West Bank.
Exactly. But we have to know something before to answer this, because if you take a look at the history of the relation between Nizar and the security apparatus of Abu Mazen, you'll find out that he was taken into as a detainee for like 10 times or 15 times before. He was beaten. He was at several times his bones were crushed, and still Nizar remained the same. In other ways, Nizar was sending a message that no matter how violent you were in dealing with me, in trying to oppress me, in trying to silence me, I will not be silent. I will remain speaking. He went to run for elections, the elections that Mahmoud Abbas canceled during the last
this was
month.
In May, yeah.
Yes. So all the voices that declared that they are against the way that Mahmoud Abbas is ruling regarding the elections and regarding the corruption with the coronavirus vaccines, also with all the security coordination with the Zionist entity.
The goal of the coordination with the Israeli entity, is it he learned from them how to suppress his own people?
Actually, he is getting paid to prevent resistance. This is the main role of the Palestinian Authority. The Oslo Accords made it clear that any authority that the Palestinian Authority to rule in the West Bank, it has to do this to prevent any act of resistance. Now I believe Mahmoud Abbas moved into another step by silencing all the voices. Not, we are not talking about taking guns or putting resistance activists inside jail. We are talking about oppression, oppression that is not serving. It's serving the goal of a dictatorship. We are talking about a dictator now. Mahmoud Abbas has turned himself into a dictator. He is no different
options,
than other
Ali,
dictators.
What are the options left for the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank to try and at least fix the situation? We don't want Palestinians fighting one another, but what options do they have?
Because the Palestinian Authority is acting as an agent of the enemy, it left no choice for the Palestinians, for the majority of the Palestinians who want to resist the occupation. They want to liberate their lands. So we are seeing now, since the assassination of Nizar, there are protests taking place in more than one city and in all in many villages in the West Bank.
It's on a daily basis. It's
yes.
Not ending.
I think this is the available choice now. Maybe there has to be done, something has to be done inside the Fatah movement, because there are free people, there are real patriots in the Fatah movement. They have to rebel against their leadership. They have to change this leadership, because in the era of victories, with the victory that the resistance
achieved
last month, the same way that Mahmoud Abbas is still ruling is outdated. I believe that
definitely incompatible. Definitely, it's something to really think about and give way for the Palestinians to decide
exactly.
For themselves. Obviously, but we hope the best for all our Palestinian brothers in the face of the occupation. Thank you very much, Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the assassination of Nizar Banat, the Palestinian activist, sadly at the hands of Palestinian authorities, security forces. Thank you very much for being with us. And please stay tuned. Next week, we have more for you on the Middle East Stream.
The limelight.
Kevo in Lapland recorded a temperature of 33.6 degrees Celsius after Finland registered record heat in June. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lisa Cox, writer. This article is published under the heading Nordic Countries Endure a Heat Wave as Lapland Records Hottest Day Since 1914. Stay tuned for more. Nordic countries have registered near record temperatures over the weekend, including highs of 34 degrees Celsius in some places. The latest figures came after Finland's National Meteorological Institute registered its hottest temperature for June since records began in 1844. Kevo in Lapland recorded heat of 33.6 degrees Celsius or 92.5 degrees Fahrenheit on Sunday, July 4th, the hottest day since 1914, when authorities registered 34.7 degrees Celsius or 94.5 degrees Fahrenheit, said the STT news agency. Several parts of Sweden also reported record highs for June. The high temperatures follow the record-breaking heat wave and wildfires that have caused devastation in parts of North America. The intense heat wave has killed 95 people in the U.S. state of Oregon alone, its governor said on Sunday, July 4th.